From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today we'll explore a new report on the state of the labor force here in Wisconsin. Then we'll look at the unionization process at Colectivo and the opportunity it gives employees when negotiating new contracts.
Those very individuals that are on the floor every day that know the working conditions, know the things that are needed by fellow coworkers, they represent those ideas when they sit down at the table.
We'll learn about the historic Concordia neighborhood, which is now expanding its 360 virtual tours of homes.
Everybody sees that this is a value to everybody in society to be able to see these houses, explore the history behind them, and it's an important asset to Milwaukee.
Lake Effect is next, but first, the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. We'll start with this. The pandemic has exacerbated and brought to light the many inequities in the low-wage labor force. Now, employees are demanding better working conditions, benefits, and wages in order to have a more sustainable lifestyle. COWS, formerly known as the Center on Wisconsin Strategy, released their annual labor report over Labor Day weekend. It looks at the pandemic's impact on the state's job market, profiles essential workers, and explores the power of unionizing. Laura Dresser is the Associate Director at COWS at UW-Madison. She spoke with Lake Effect's Mallory Chang.
Thank you so much, Laura, for joining me here on Lake Effect. So just to start it off, COWS recently released the State of Working Wisconsin report, and this year really incorporating the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic that is still ongoing. Could you tell me a bit about this report?
I first came to COWS in 1995, and one of my first jobs was to write our first edition of the State of Working Wisconsin. Last summer, looking at the complete and profound disruption caused by the pandemic, we really changed what we were doing. We moved the report online. It's at workingwi.org, and we tried to kind of grapple more with exactly how work was changing and what that meant for working people.
Yeah, definitely. And what I noticed when I was going through the report, too, that a lot of the themes that was touched on in the report is definitely also reflecting what's happening nationally. For example, like around the country, employers are scrambling to find employees to fill open positions. And as we're moving the pandemic, job seekers are demanding increased wages and calling on employers to really improve working conditions. In 2020, you all spoke with various workers across Wisconsin and in various sectors and checked back in with them again this year. What did you hear from them? And did they align with what is happening on the national scale?
I think some of the things that we heard really, really do align. We had a nurse who we spoke to last year and this summer. And I think the story of healthcare workers is definitely one of just exhaustion. The pandemic has been hard for all of us. And I know even the privileged ones of us who get to work in the safety of our homes, you know, everything's disrupted in a way. But the people who are exposed in their work and have been exposed from before when, you know, when there were no vaccines and there was no equipment to keep people safe and very little knowledge actually about how the disease moves. So in all those ways, I think healthcare workers have really faced an enormous amount of pressure. And then to see the numbers surge, to have the ICU numbers and the hospitalization numbers in the state surge this summer, I think we got real exhaustion and stress and frustration from that healthcare, from that nurse. But also we spoke to a nursing home worker, and these are workers that I think are really so central to our understanding of both the problems in the low-wage labor market and the problems the pandemic pressed into focus. So certified nursing assistants tend to be really low paid. This often work without even health insurance provided through their job. You know, the hands of the healthcare industry really can't even get health insurance. And they dealt with the outbreaks, the very high mortality rates, and also the lockdowns that put them in the position as being the only contact for family, the only contact for residents. So there was enormous emotional stress and burden on certified nursing assistants in nursing homes across the state. That worker felt a lot better this summer, I would say, but still is facing a lot of fear about being a vector into or out of that space. The one bit of good news, if you want me to go on and on, we talked to one other worker who lost three jobs. And I think this is a really important story. He was a food service worker in Milwaukee, and he had pieced together three jobs and lost all three of them in the pandemic. And that's very indicative of what happened in leisure and hospitality and food service. Workers lost jobs at incredible numbers. That sector still is 20% below where it was before the pandemic. He's back to a job. He got called back by one job. He gets a lot of hours from that job. They're shorter staffed to keep more space between people. So it's kind of a little more stressful, but he's got work again. And also his kids were doing school from home, and he found that required a full-time tech support slash dad, you know, as part of the picture. And his kids being back to school make an enormous difference. And I know that story is really important for so many parents this year, having the kids going back to classrooms.
Laura, you also just mentioned in the report too about the issues with the low wage labor market. Could you expand a little bit about that? What did the report really find about this market, and what are some issues that are coming out from it?
In the state of working Wisconsin, we've often highlighted the structure of low-wage jobs for all along with the report. And what I think is unique about the pandemic is that the very workers who have the lowest wages, the weakest benefits, lack of health insurance, those jobs which exist in our labor market were the very workers who lost their jobs or were exposed through work. So the inequality in our labor markets was always pronounced. But then in the context of the pandemic, mostly not true for doctors and nurses, but mostly people with higher levels of education and jobs that are more computer-based got to move into their houses, got to be safe and maintain a paycheck. But in those bottom jobs, the jobs that pay least in our labor market, workers faced job loss and exposure if they kept the job. So that both of those pressures were really concentrated on the workers who had the weakest health insurance, the weakest leave policies, and the least income coming in to survive the crushing blow of the restructuring that the pandemic caused.
Another aspect of the report, too, that I do want to touch on was about unions. Across the country, it seems like there's an increase of visibility of unions across all sectors. Most notably recently, the food establishment Colectivo created a union, and there's talks also of Starbucks employees in Buffalo who also in the food service industry are organizing together. Could you talk a little bit, why are unions coming more to the forefront, and what is the stance in Wisconsin on them?
Coming in even to the pandemic, we were seeing more mobilization of workers, more active and vocal campaigns around improving jobs, whether that was the Red for Ed walkouts, the teachers in West Virginia and Oklahoma, the LA teachers strike in Los Angeles. There was a lot of educator organizing and mobilization, but there was also work stoppages in other places and organizing drives beginning to pick up. And that was at a kind of very high level of activity, even coming into the pandemic nationally. But I think then, like I've been saying, the pandemic really crystallized some of these issues. Like, we're going to call these workers essential, but their jobs are not structured in a way that allows for the things that we think are essential to life. Right now, at the national level, unions are more popular than they've been in generations, like if you just ask people. So the polling on unions is good. And I think that also relates to the incredible inequality we have in our society. We just see increasing rewards. You know, you look at the pandemic and everybody buys everything from Amazon, and Bezos makes $1 billion and the Amazon workers are like, we're supposed to celebrate that they're finally up to $15 an hour. So, you know, I think the tensions and the disparities have really shone a spotlight on these issues as well. The picture on Wisconsin unions is unique. You know, in 2010, the state of Wisconsin, led by then Governor Scott Walker, passed Act 10, which restructured the way public sector unions worked in the state and really diminished their ability to deliver on the promise of what unions can do. So public sector unionization from 2011 to now has fallen by half. And Wisconsin from 2011 to now has gone from being a relatively highly unionized state, higher than the national average, to well below the national average. And I think that's a direct result of Act 10 and the right to work law that the state passed in 2015, which changes the terms of private sector unionization. So our decline in unionization is intense and among the worst of our neighbors. Iowa slightly outstrips us, but all of us at the state of Minnesota actually has a higher share of its workforce represented by unions today than it did 10 years ago. And this speaks to the real importance of state policy and the way that states have a lot to do with unions as well. So that's a kind of important difference about Wisconsin. And that's maybe why it's so inspiring to see things like Collectivo and other work of unions and working people organizing, because the ground is really hard against them and you still see workers organizing.
So in the report, there was a section that asked, when will we go back to what normal was? What is the new normal? And with the report, and as we're coming through that year and a half out after being affected, continuing to be affected by the pandemic, what will the future of working conditions look like? And should we go back to what was quote unquote normal before the pandemic?
I appreciate you bringing up this question, because to me, you know, there is such an urge in all of us just to get to something that we know in a way, what get back to where things were. But in this report, consistently, and anybody who's working in these service sector jobs, those jobs were structured in ways that were unsustainable and really hard to survive, to raise a family, to keep a roof over your head, to keep food on the table, let alone to get health insurance or decent hours in your job. All of these things, these packages, the job that bad jobs came in were part of the reality, part of that normal. And if we can seize this moment and take what we've learned about what's essential and really restructure what have been some of our lowest wage jobs, really honor that work. And if the workers who are doing that work continue to lead, you know, through unionization and through demanding more from their employers, and policy also responds through extending supports on the health insurance or childcare side of things, these things are really going to be what we need. We need a new normal, and we learned it better and we saw it more across the pandemic. And I hope that that's what this pandemic does for us.
Thank you so much, Laura, for being here on Lake Effect. And this is really important for our state to see and to hear about, to really think about and rethink how should we create a more equitable workplace. So thank you so much, Laura.
Thank you so much for having me.
Laura Dresser is the Associate Director at COWS, formerly known as the Center on Wisconsin Strategy at UW-Madison. She spoke with Lake Effect's Mallory Chang. Coming up in about 20 minutes, Bubbler Talk explores how animals get to the Milwaukee County Zoo. But first, we'll take an in-depth look at what the unionizing process can mean for employees here in Wisconsin. We'll hear from a Colectivo employee and a representative from their new union, the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. That's coming up on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Last month, workers at Colectivo Coffee voted to join a union. It was the culmination of more than a year of work, and the process was not without controversy. Colectivo, the company, was openly against the decision and hired an anti-union company called the Labor Relations Institute to help convince employees not to unionize. That effort failed. Now, Colectivo employees are represented by the IBEW, also known as the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. Ida Lucchesi is one of the employees who fought to make this happen, and she joins me now to talk about what this experience has been like. What was the unionization process like for you as an employee?
It's been a long process. We've been working at it for about 18 months. And I would say like the biggest takeaway for me was how much I learned about what unions are in general, and then how other people reacted to them, like the existing ideas that are surrounding unions. So that was what I feel like I've learned the most in these past 18 months.
For you, how did your view of unions change as you learned more about what they do?
I feel like I've always had a pretty positive view about unions. My dad has been in a union for as long as I can remember. And so I always looked at them positively, but I didn't exactly know what they could do. So it's been even more positive as I've learned more, like learning what resources they can provide you with, what protections you have under the law, and what your employer can and can't do has been really empowering.
As an employee of Colectivo, were there specific things that made you want to unionize in the first place?
Yeah, so when we started talking about this in March of 2020, a group of employees came together, and because we were talking about how we didn't feel like we were being heard. So in March of 2020, we put together a petition to close our cafes for 2 weeks while we could figure out a plan. And while that was heard, we did get that. It felt like there were a lot of other concerns that needed to be addressed that weren't being addressed. So it really came down to communication and trying to advocate for ourselves is initially why we started a union. And then as we connected with more people throughout the company, as we got more people from Chicago on the campaign, we learned of more unique issues that people were facing. So those came into play over time.
Colectivo, the company, hasn't been a proponent of unionization. How have you felt working there as this process was going on, but also now that you are part of a union?
There were definitely times where it felt more tense than I was ready for. It felt like I often was trying to navigate between being like a customer service personality, kind of, so like doing my job and then recognizing my needs. So there was a navigation between that and like when to bring up something that was bugging me or when to kind of wait until something bigger happened. So it was hard to navigate between that like personal and then role of the job.
Now that you are part of a union, what are you most looking forward to? What do you think these protections are going to bring you as you move forward in your job?
Yeah, so a union is really like a redistribution of the power. So I think that once we get started on the process of our collective bargaining agreement and move past that, once that happens, like we'll definitely have a bigger voice as employees at the table. So our input will be heard and taken more seriously because that'll be in a contract. Immediately, something I'm looking forward to is we have, they're called Weingarten rights now. So as an employee, if we think we're getting pulled into a meeting that could result in disciplinary action, we have the right to have a union representative in that meeting with us. So like another party in there to kind of just listen to what's being said and holds people accountable in a way that we didn't have those rights before. So that's really promising to know that there's that security just in case anything could happen. And then that we'll have somebody there who knows more about like the actual laws that we're operating under and things like that. So that like additional education in the workplace as well as accountability.
All right. Well, Ida, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing what this process has been like for you.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate you having me.
Ida Lucchesi is one of the employees who helped Colectivo Workers unionize last month. These employees are now represented by the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers Union, also known as IBEW. John Jacobs is the Assistant Business Manager for IBEW Local 494, which represents employees here in Milwaukee. He joins me now to talk about what this process has been like. John, thank you so much for being here on Lake Effect.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity.
What do Colectivo employees get through unionizing that they otherwise wouldn't have?
Sure. I think first and foremost is when successful, both sides actually get out of it a collective bargaining agreement. Collectively, the two parties sat down, discussed the terms and conditions within, and agreed to it. And when you do that, it provides a lot of clarity instead of a lot of gray. That is ultimately what both parties get out of it. It allows employees a seat at the table to have those discussions. Contrary to what we've heard out there, that it's the union is a third party, what people forget is the union is its membership. And when it comes time to negotiate a contract, those very individuals that are on the floor every day that know the working conditions, know the things that are needed by fellow coworkers, they represent those ideas when they sit down at the table.
So for people who haven't experienced the unionizing process, what does that look like? What did it look like for Colectivo?
Sure. So it first starts with obviously the discussion. And I can tell you the story from Colectivo's side and how they approached it was they first started with the Teamsters. They did not start with the IBEW. And they did basically an interview. They interviewed with the Teamsters, and I think primarily because the Teamsters went through their efforts with Stone Creek Coffee. And then ultimately, they turned to the IBEW and interviewed the IBEW. And they liked what came out of the interview and decided to move forward with that. From there, you have discussions. We had weekly meetings. It was an open meeting for anyone that was interested in talking and start to get to know each other, right? You start to build that trust. And at the same time, you create informational websites. You put on those websites as far as card signing. And basically, you're saying that I would like to have, in this case, Local 494 or Local 1220, which is out of Illinois, represent me. So you have the card signing. And basically, when you collect enough cards, you turn those into the NLRB, the National Labor Relations Board. And when you have enough cards signed, you can move forward with an election. And there were enough cards signed. There was an election that took place at the beginning of this year, around March. The ballots were turned in, the ballots are counted. And if you're successful, then you move to the next step where you sit down and begin to negotiate your first contract. So that's a summary of how things are accomplished. If someone is out there contemplating becoming a union for the first time, those are the steps that took place.
Sure. You mentioned the workers at Colectivo had first approached the Teamsters. And I will say, I didn't exactly understand the connection between the kind of work they do at Colectivo and your union, the IBEW, which is electrical workers, I believe. What is that connection?
Sure. And we've heard that before. And ultimately, the connection is I'll give an example of internally of some of the contracts that we oversee. We oversee sign shops, motor shops, panel shops. And so those go outside of the bulk of our group, if you will, that's inside journey people, right? That do electrical construction. And so I go back to the same thing with Colectivo is the folks that are on the floor know the best of what's going on. And that's why they are part of negotiations. And so really what we partake as far as the negotiations is we help facilitate. We have the resources. We have the knowledge at the international level that if we need something, we'll reach out to them, all in an effort to assist them when they negotiate their contracts. So the common thread, of course, is becoming union and negotiating. But outside of that, it's the individuals that know best what's needed.
Hmm. Colectivo, the company, hasn't been supportive of these union efforts. Did that complicate this process?
It complicated the process when they decided to hire the Labor Relations Institute, otherwise known as LRI. They're a very well-known outfit that does not want to see the union succeed at a company. They put that out on their website. They have it on their website, and they're quoted as saying, every day we are educating employees somewhere about the disadvantages of unions. And so when they had these mandatory meetings for employees to attend where LRI was present, we got word back that the employees were very educated when they went there and participated in these meetings, to the point that they questioned LRI, why is it okay for you to have a contract with Colectivo, but we can't?
As we look forward to the future for Colectivo employees, what do you hope this union will give them at the bargaining table?
Certainly, first and foremost, a voice. And when you have a voice and you're able to sit down with management and you have the backing of fellow 300 employees with their ideas, even those that voted no, you have an obligation to represent them. I look at it typically like any election, right? Whether it be presidential candidate, governor candidate, there are people that don't vote for that individual. But that individual ultimately has to represent them, right, for their interests and the common good. And so the same thing here with Colectivo. Ultimately, by having a voice and having the backing, they participate in the process. And when you do so, that says a lot. It gives them the ability to come up with new ideas, to sit down with management, basically on the same level playing field, to improve business, to improve those relationships moving forward. And when you have that collective bargaining agreement, I go back to the gray areas start to disappear. Everything becomes more clear for both sides.
So the IBEW recently held what you call a reverse boycott. Can you explain what that was about?
The thought process with the reverse boycott is contrary to what I guess a stereotype is out there regarding unions, that, oh, we're going to go on strike or we're going to hurt the company. If you really think about it, does that make any sense whatsoever with the employees? They're out of work then. It makes zero sense. And so ultimately, it was a means to show support, especially Labor Day weekend, of all weekends to do it. Show support for the employees. At the same time, you're showing support to the company. Yes, even though they've come along and they're not for this, and it's ultimately to show there can be a win-win in all of this if you just take a step back and look at it, especially when you're talking about an international organization, which is between Canada and the United States, the IBEW, of over 650,000 members. That's just members. That doesn't include their significant others, their family members, the relationships we have with the building trades, all the unions. I mean, you're talking over 1 million people. Now imagine if each person bought one bag of coffee. That is a lot. We have our international convention coming up next May, which is held once in 5 years. And this coming year in 2022, it's going to be hosted in Chicago. Can you imagine if we are successful in getting our first contract? There is locations in Chicago. And if you're the sole provider for coffee for that convention, I mean, that's where I'm going with these relationships that we could have with the owners of Lincoln, Ward, and Paul at Colectivo to expand on what they have already.
All right. Well, John, thank you so much for taking the time out to share your work.
Thank you, Joy.
John Jacobs is the Assistant Business Manager for IBEW Local 494, which represents Colectivo workers here in Milwaukee. At WUWM.com, you can find more of our coverage on Colectivo's union push. Coming up, Bubbler Talk will explore how animals get to the Milwaukee County Zoo and the extraordinary work that goes into mentally preparing an animal for their journey.
they do work with that animal for, you know, sometimes months to get them used to maybe a crate, to get them familiar with the crate. They know who's going to be going with them. That's all planned out well in advance of their trip out.
But first, we'll learn about the historic Concordia neighborhood, from its history to its grand houses. That's next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWN, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Milwaukee's historic Concordia neighborhood has a rich history dating back to 1850. Old world craftsmanship is found in mid-size homes and large mansions alike, with architectural styles ranging from Cream City brick Gothic to Victorian and Mission style homes. Many of the neighborhood's historic mansions were demolished in the 1950s through the 70s. Others were converted into rooming houses or left to decline. But Historic Concordia Neighbors Incorporated keeps preservation and education as their main mission in keeping up the homes that remain. This year, Historic Concordia Neighbors is offering free virtual tours of homes in the neighborhood, including the Manderley Bed and Breakfast. Andrew and Marie Parker are the proprietors of the B&B, and they join Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski to share more about their neighborhood.
So going into a bit of the history of the neighborhood itself, you know, when was it first really established and what was it known for? You know, why is it called Concordia?
Right. So the cool thing is Concordia wasn't really here. It was just a road that went through here, and it was the Watertown Plank Road, which was a toll road, which they built with, you know, big timbers, and they laid them all the way to Watertown. And that route eventually became State Street. When they decided to annex it as the city, they established the street grid pattern, which makes for an interesting place in a couple of different areas. You can still see where the old Watertown Plank Road was, because the houses are set back strangely compared to the rest of the city grid.
You mentioned before that a lot of houses were established during the Victorian era. A lot of these homes are bigger, you know, it's a lot were converted into rooming houses later on in their lives. But to have such a big home from the start, what kind of people were first settling in the Concordia neighborhood?
They primarily from Germany. And you think about settlers, early settlers and late settlers, they're escaping from something, not these guys. They came with pocketfuls of cash. They came with their bakers, their brewers, their craftsmen, and recreated. They called it Little Berlin here. So Concordia was known as Little Berlin or New Berlin. And so that spread, come on down. We've got these great churches and houses, and everything's taken off, and the weather's fine. Right. Come on down.
So the whole area was primarily settled by wealthy Germans. And these eventually, you know, that was the early settlers. And then eventually it became the wealthiest area of the state. These were the power brokers. These were the Pabsts and the Millers and the Harleys and the Davidsons and many, many very, very rich and powerful people from the state of Wisconsin lived here, including our house, which is pretty cool.
We did a little research on, so we're about 2 miles straight west from Lake Michigan, and Victorians felt that lake air was not good for your constitution. You couldn't live right on there. So they went and swam and kind of vacationed on bodies of waters, but not to live. So that is why we are this far away from Lake Michigan.
Right. If you look at a map, an old map of this area of Milwaukee, it kind of juts out, and it's called the West End. And it is where the rich people lived and played. Cold Spring Park at that time was a racetrack. And back in the day, horse racing was a big deal in Milwaukee. And they had the state fair there every year for many, many years before it moved to the state fairgrounds. So if you look at Cold Spring Park, which is just to the north of us, that used to be where the people of our area used to go and play and make bets and all of that.
Washington Park was the zoo.
Right. Washington Park was the zoo. So we had close proximity to some really cool things. So Cold Spring Park is now all houses, and they've filled in like after 1900, basically, is when that filled in. But ours is, you know, our house was built in 1886. it wasn't the first one around here. There were many around.
So when did you first move into this neighborhood at the house you're currently at right now? And what struck you about the neighborhood itself?
So I'm from Milwaukee and grew up over on 48th and North. So I'm a city kid, you know, not scared of the city, embraced the city and loved the place. Graduated from Washington High School and then went on to Marquette University. And then after I graduated from Marquette, I got a job at Marquette. So I thought, well, I should probably buy a house around here. So I went looking, and then in that's like mid-1980s. At the same time, there was a group called the Westside Conservation Corporation. And what they did was they bought a bunch of old houses from the old Concordia College. Concordia College used to be the center of this neighborhood. And they've since moved to Mequon. And when they left many, many houses that were student housing and things that they owned. And this Westside Conservation Corporation came in and redid all the houses to make them like new. So all new heating and systems and updating the electrical, whatever you needed. And then they marketed them to families to come and be urban pioneers. And I bought the last Concordia house that was here. It was a Victorian over on 34th Street. And it was owned by Hugo Tooley's, who's the original guy who built it. So if you look downtown, there's a building called Tooley's building. That was his building, and they were furniture manufacturers, and they lived in Concordia, and that was the first house that I bought here.
And I'm from Greenfield, Wisconsin, so houses were ranch and newer build construction, and then I did a couple internships, summer internships in Chicago, suburb of Evanston, and fell in love with these cool old, great old Victorian homes. And then when I met Andrew, he was already living in one of those cool great old homes that reminded me very much of Evanston. And so that was right up my alley, you know, with the built-ins, the oak, the walnut, the maple, the stained glass, the carved woods, and the crazy niches and the size of all these homes. It was pretty cool.
Right. The charm of these great old houses. I mean, it really can't be beat.
It's true. So you guys currently operate the Manderley Bed and Breakfast in one of these very grand old historic Victorian homes. So what made you want to do this? And did you always want to run a bed and breakfast in Milwaukee? I mean, I feel like a lot of other states maybe are known for bed and breakfasts, but we don't think of, oh, I'm going to do a staycation and go to a bed and breakfast in Milwaukee in a different neighborhood.
It is so funny that you say that, because when we got married, we went and stayed in different bed and breakfasts all the way down to Jekyll Island, Georgia. And then we were hooked. By the time we got back, we knew we wanted to have a bed and breakfast someday.
But Milwaukee, that's unheard of. There's no breakfast in Milwaukee. And we did a little preliminary research and found out there are so many rules and regulations against the bed and breakfast from the hotel industry, like the B&Bs are going to take over. So we started vacationing and vacationing to find a B&B. So every place where we went, we did our research and looked at these great old homes, but they were $1.5 million plus, and then not even everything that was on our checklist that we had written out. So then we were living in Concordia, like we say, and so kind of searching and not even thinking about Milwaukee, you know, ready to make the move.
It was not even on our radar.
And lo and behold, this house comes up on the market. And we took a tour, and it was exactly what we were looking for. It had everything on our checklist. It had the double doors when you walk through. It had the open grand staircase. It had a private quarters for us. It had 8 bedrooms total. It had a giant yard and on and on and on.
It was missing a lot of things.
Because it was turned into a rooming house, so it was missed a lot. Right. But yet, it had everything that we were looking for. It just needed a lot. We call it grand fixer-upper.
Right. It had the potential to have everything we wanted. We hadn't really considered an urban location as ideal, but it turns out an urban-like location for a bed and breakfast is
perfect. Because there's always something going on in Milwaukee year-round that it attracts.
Well, and I imagine you always had a project going on when you first bought this house, and it took you about 7 years to put it together to the standard you wanted in order to operate a bed and breakfast. So what was your favorite challenge?
Wow. Favorite challenge.
Well, that's a good question.
Do those two words go together? Yeah. The most dramatic challenge was the house was missing almost all of its stained glass windows. So what do? You measure your stained glass windows, write down what is needed in what rooms, what would have been appropriate. You know, we know the age, we've researched everything, and you got stained glass window shopping and you find they don't fit. They're too expensive. This isn't going to happen. So Andy had already been dabbling a little bit in making stained glass windows, and he's very creative, very artistic. So he starts drawing and turning these drawings into stained glass windows. And he's created, some in every room, some stained glass windows in every room. They're pretty dramatic and awesome. And lots of people think that they are original to the house, which is quite a nice compliment.
That is a good compliment.
I think the worst challenge, but you have to do it, is stripping woodwork. For me, that is the most tedious, hardest things. All of our mantles were missing. So we had to find mantles that would fit and that we could afford. We know that what was here was probably larger and more grand, but these are pretty cool mantles and appropriate to the year. And we could afford them because they had 10, 15, 20 layers of paint on them. Mm-hmm. So that took quite a long time, and toothbrush and heat gun and chemicals and all of the above to strip and bring back these cool old mantles.
Yeah, the stained glass you mentioned, one thing that struck me looking through some of the photos of your home was the grand, awesome oak double doors with the stained glass in the windows. Like, and I also assumed, oh, that must have been there. How amazing is that?
Why, thank you.
Thank you. Those doors weren't even there.
So the inside vestibule doors were missing. So the people who turned this mansion into a rooming house stripped it. They took out those double doors and sold it, the headset, to us, to San Francisco. So a lot of the goods from the house are living on in San Francisco.
Seeing your home, you know, obviously people can stay in it, but with the historic Concordia Neighbors Incorporated, there are both in-person self-guided tours, times of year they can go into homes, but now there's also a virtual tour. So what was the process like to take the landscape of the inside of your home and turn it into a digital tour so that we can explore it on our computer screens?
We have a secret weapon, and that secret weapon is a human called Scott Witte. And he is a professional photographer, and he does those 360, he specializes in that.
He's our neighbor also. He lives over on Highland, and he's a genius with anything video. And he moved into it from still photography. He's an advertising photographer. And he made it so easy, to be honest with you. All we did was, you know, clear the room out and, you know, make it pretty. And then he would come in and make it visual for anybody who wants to see. So it's great.
Yeah, a group of us got together, and it was a grant, Andrew?
I believe so.
And to make that happen, to make that happen, and it is widely received. We've gotten calls from all over the country. And how did you do that? What was your first step? What was your second step? It was a big project.
Mm-hmm. I suppose the biggest thing is getting people to agree to have their home fully photographed, and you know, not just a still photo, but you know, you're really going through it. And we are very, very lucky in Concordia that everybody gets it. Everybody sees that this is a value to everybody in society to be able to see these houses, explore the history behind them. And it's an important asset to Milwaukee. And we understand that. So everybody kind of opens up their houses when we ask them to, and they're private homes. They're not museums. So they're just people just like you and I who are living in a house, you know, doing the repairs, fixing it up, and they just happen to be some pretty cool houses.
Yeah. So through hcni.org, we already have the app, and it was doing quite well. And then we added on to it for the last two home tours. We stayed virtual for 2 years through COVID, and we ramped it up. We added all kinds of new houses and new features and private chats with homeowners. So it's really incredible now. And we wouldn't have gotten to the level that it is now if we wouldn't have gone virtual for 2 years. It's pretty spectacular now.
What's your favorite part of living in the Concordia neighborhood that you want people to know about and explore for themselves, whether they're able to come by in person or explore it virtually?
I don't know if you can explore this, you know, being a somebody else coming in, but certainly my favorite part of the neighborhood is the neighbors. It's the people that make the neighborhood. I mean, you're drawn here because of the houses. The houses are great, but the real benefit is having such great neighbors who are friends of yours.
You know, we share the love of old houses, so we have that in common. And let's say you do buy a home in the Concordia Historic District, you're not alone. You have this army of people that have been through it or will go through with you. You get people.
Well, Andrew and Marie, I want to thank you so much for giving us a little bit of insight into your home and your neighborhood.
Great. Thanks for having us.
Thanks.
Andrew and Marie Parker are the proprietors of the Manderly Bed and Breakfast in Milwaukee's historic Concordia neighborhood. Their house and many others are available to be explored in 360-degree virtual tours. You'll find a link to that and more at WUWM.com.
Bubbler Talk, quenching Milwaukee's thirst for knowledge.
People have a lot of questions when they come to the Milwaukee County Zoo. But the most important one may be this: how did all of these animals even get here? That question can be interpreted a couple ways. How does a zoo get permission to add a new animal, and how do the animals physically get to Wisconsin? Let's start with that first question. Despite some common misconceptions, accredited zoos no longer take animals from the wild. And the zoo can't just order up a family of elephants or gorillas. There's a whole process, and it starts with the Association of Zoos and Aquariums, also known as the AZA.
There's roughly 250 zoos throughout the country that belong to the AZA and are accredited.
That's Jennifer Diliberti from the Milwaukee County Zoo.
So when we look to have an animal transfer to another zoo, it's all based on species survival plans, in that they look at all the zoos that are accredited as one population. So when an animal needs to move, a lot of times it's for genetic reasons.
That species survival plan she mentioned, also known as an SSP, is the key to knowing which animals should end up here in Milwaukee. Patricia Kahn, curator of primates and small mammals at the Milwaukee County Zoo, explains how these plans work.
The species survival plans are made up of experts in the field of the captive population. And the SSP, every few years, will put out a breeding and transfer plan. And that's based on the viability of the population, where the population is now, and where they want the population to be in, say, 5 generations or 100 years from now.
One of the main goals is to create a genetically diverse group of animals in captivity to avoid inbreeding and keep their lines healthy. And there are other things they take into account, like herd dynamics at each facility, an animal's temperament, and its natural life cycle.
You move animals at certain ages. You know, young females would naturally move out in the wild at a certain age, and you try to keep within those limits. That plays a huge role into the whole decision on when we move animals. It's not something that you take on lightly.
Once the association and the zoos have figured out which animals should come to Milwaukee, they need to figure out how it'll get here. You can't exactly pack gorillas into the family minivan, but it does take a family effort to make them comfortable with the journey.
They do work with that animal for, you know, sometimes months to get them used to maybe a crate, to get them familiar with the crate. They know who's going to be going with them. That's all planned out well in advance of their trip out.
Kahn describes how this played out when a family of gorillas was recently transferred from the Columbus Zoo to Milwaukee.
We sent our keepers to Columbus a few days before the shipment so that those keepers could spend time with the Columbus Zoo keepers. They could talk, and they could also spend time with the gorillas there and get to know them, and the gorillas could get to know them. Then the transfer happened, and everybody came together. So the animals were never left alone. All the animals could see each other on that transport. They were in the same truck. They could smell and see each other, but they also had their recognized staff with them.
Like any family trip, there are different ways to get to an animal's final destination. Those gorillas came to Milwaukee by truck, but if an animal is coming from farther away, they may come by plane, both cargo and commercial flights when necessary. The goal is to keep them comfortable and ensure their safety every step of the way. And reaching their new home here in Milwaukee isn't the end of that journey. It's just the beginning. Over the next weeks and months, they'll be introduced to their new home and family. It's the start of their new lives and the beginning of our journey with them at the Milwaukee County Zoo. For Bubbler Talk, I'm Joy Powers. Daddy's taking us to the
zoo tomorrow. Zoo. Support for Bubbler Talk comes from Landmark Credit Union and Palermo's Pizza. What have you always wanted to know about the Milwaukee area? Visit wuwm.com/bubblertalk to submit your question.
Bubbler Talk is a regular series here on Lake Effect, and you can hear it every Monday at noon and 8. You can also find our previous seasons of Bubbler Talk at wuwm.com. And that wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for being here with us. I'm Joy Powers. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, voting rights activist Stacey Abrams. We'll talk about the biggest barriers to the ballot box here in Wisconsin. Plus, we'll have the first installment of a new series called Pandemic Reflections, featuring Derek Mosley, a presiding judge of the Milwaukee Municipal Courts and a COVID-19 survivor. That's all tomorrow at noon, right here on Lake Effect, on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.